Our guest today is a prominent Kashmiri politician, a Shia cleric, and a member of the Indian Parliament, Aga Rehullah. Welcome, Aga Sahab, to RT.
Thank you.
I want to have this discussion today with you about what's happening in Iran, in West Asia, the broader Muslim world, from a lens of theology, because whatever is happening in the world today, at the center of it is religion. Let me begin with my first question, Aga Sahab. We're seeing Kashmiri Muslims with so much love, affection, emotion, donate cash, gold, children breaking their piggy banks. What explains this connect that Kashmir has with Iran?
Arrival of Islam in Kashmir came through the saints who mostly were from Iran. Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani is the prominent name who brought Islam to the valley of Kashmir. He was from Iran. He brought his disciples with him, who not only taught Islam in the valley, but also taught handicrafts, who taught, craft to the people of Kashmir, with which the entire society changed, both religiously and economically, more than the culture, the religion itself. It has ties, the people of Jammu and Kashmir have ties with the people, the scholars in Iran, Muslims in Kashmir, and particularly a section of Muslims called Shias look towards the scholars in Iran and Iraq for jurisprudent guidance. Mostly the scholars that we have in today's time who are well educated and equipped with these skills come from Iraq and mostly from Iran. So that's why you see this kind of reaction. It's because Kashmir has cultural ties. You can see that in language of Kashmir. Kashmiri language has many words which comes from Persian language.
You yourself, you're named after the first Ayatollah. You have studied in Iran as well. What for you has stood out both spiritually and intellectually?
You need to understand a couple of things when I address this question. People might think that it's extremism or it's fundamentalism in the center of all these conversations when we talk about Ayatollahs, when we talk about scholars. No, it's beyond that. Post-revolution, Islamic Revolution, 1979, people could see that there is a scholarship who can stand for the rights of the oppressed and who can translate the principles and the fundamentals of religion in favor of oppressed and try to speak for the oppressed. And that's where this connection with the scholars grew beyond imaginations. That became inspirational. If we had ties with Iran used to be Iran before 1979 as well, but people of any part of the world didn't have this kind of emotional ties with Iran. It's only because of the awakening of the people in that section, those who were looked up to in scholarly circles, when they took this responsibility and came out in favor of the people who were oppressed and challenged the might. They challenged the imperialist might in Iran itself. They overthrew a government which was not a democracy, which was not accountable to its people, which was oppressing the people. And that's why the inspiration went out of the borders of Iran and inspired people throughout. That's where my name also comes from. It's the inspiration. My grandfather was inspired with that revolutionary leader. My name comes from that inspiration. And that's how this emotion grew. People started looking at this scholarly seat, not particularly the Iranian government, the scholarly seat that we see as a guiding factor in Iran's politics. And we see that it is trying to, or it is attempting to, align itself with the principles of Islam, where it comes for the moral direction, ethical direction, and political direction. That's why we think this was very inspirational.
When the West says that they assassinated the supreme leader of Iran, they say that they've done a favor to the people of the nation because he was oppressing people, he was oppressing women, he was anti-feminist. How do you react to that?
Well, the problem with the West is that they think because they have might, military might, they can dictate the vocabulary, they can dictate what is right and what is wrong. And the worldview should be aligned with West. And the standards that West sets should be applied by everyone. They say someone is an oppressor without understanding whether that person or that government qualifies for the term oppression. Because the West has said so, we have to accept that. Well, if the Iranian government has oppressed its people, that's for the people of Iran to judge and to decide. It's not the West's business to interfere in any country's internal matters. What is it the West has with the clothes of or the clothing of a woman? Why does the West want to objectify a woman? If a society has grown in a culture, in an understanding, in a religion where they have their own standards for men and women, and women willingly and out of their free will abide by those standards, those principles, why should that hurt or why should that offend West? Islam has a different take. That culture has a different take on women, and she can be covered and she can be free at the same time. She can do whatever she wants. And if we go by statistics, more number of women in Iranian society are scientists than in America. More number of women hold official jobs in Iranian society than in America. Why isn't these indicators enough for America to call that society, yes, there's enough freedom for women? So this is a standard which we need to call out. West cannot set the standards for the rest of the world. West has no political authority. West has no moral authority. If they talk about killing, and these numbers are highly exaggerated, 30,000, 40,000, the protesters were killed. No one has provided any evidence for that. No one knows that. And if that is to be taken as an argument, what about the genocide that was carried out in Gaza very recently? More than 70,000 people were killed. Those powers are not called to accountability, and they are not labeled the way the others who are not as equipped as America are labeled.
After the killing of Ayatollah Khomeini and Iran's reaction, do you think that it has hardened, widened the fault lines, the Shia and the Sunni divide in the world?
No, it has done the other way around. It's been a blessing. It has brought the unity among Shias and Sunnis, and Muslim population has come closer to each other. Ayatollah Khamenei's martyrdom has done a blessing for the unity of Ummah or the Muslim society. If you do an analysis on how the online world has reacted to this situation, I think the Arab Sunni population has come out very sympathetic towards Iran, very sympathetic towards Ayatollah Khamenei, and in support of their cause. I'm not talking about the Arab rulers, those kings and princes. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the population. In India, you could see the reaction. The money that you talked about that was collected as an aid for Iran didn't come from Shias only. A major portion of it came from Sunni population, and I have evidences a good portion of it came from Hindu population as well. Because they see there is someone or a nation which has stood to might of the West, might of the aggressors, and challenging it.
The Gulf-Iran tensions, they're often framed as the Shia-Sunni divide. Do you think that's oversimplification of political alignments?
It is how the West has tried to confuse it. Political denomination and political hostility towards each other is something which is created by the British Empire, imperialist empire. We in India are witness to it. The divide and rule policy of British Empire was pretty much effective. and it was pretty much a tool in their arsenal. They implemented it, and that's how it was used in Middle East as well, the Arab and immediate non-Arab world, which includes Iran. They identified the gaps between problem areas between the society. Here they could divide people on religious basis, denominating Hindus and Muslims. In Arab world and West Asia, they were all Muslims. They divided them in different sections. Politically, the Shia-Sunni element was fanned by British Empire. And this is the continuity of that.
Ayatollah Khomeini, he led Iran for around 35 years. He was 85 himself. He was very aware of the risks coming his way. Yet, he didn't choose to go into a bunker or a safe house. Does this reflect the Islamic idea of shahadat, of martyrdom?
It is purely because of that. If you take that element out of it, you wouldn't see such kind of thing. You would see a person fleeing from his country. Because
so many thought he might just take a plane to Moscow.
There were speculations. If you take that element into it, then your life becomes very important for you. And your life becomes everything for you. Your positions become everything for you. So we have had scholars throughout history, but no scholar, or hardly any scholar, has been a political inspiration as Imam Khomeini or Ayatollah Khomeini or Ayatollah Khamenei has been. Why they inspired people throughout politically as well? Because they brought the inspiration or the concepts of the book to life. You need to understand, and this name is often taken in the Muslim world, and that's why it's heard in non-Muslim world, the event of Karbala. Event of Karbala gives Imam Hussein only two options, either death or compromise. He chose to sacrifice his life so that that idea of justice remains alive. And come back to this event. Had he fled Ayatollah Khamenei, had he fled, that would mean that he gave up on the rights of his people, rights of his nation, the principles that he stood for, the idea of justice. That would mean that everyone has to submit to the might of the West and Israel. Or you can manifest these teachings like Imam Hussein did. West may come with whatever might it has. They can take your life, but they cannot take your right to stand for what you stand for. So therefore, with your sacrifice, that ultimate objective will remain alive. And that is what it has translated into. It has galvanized not only Iran, but people from around the world for the cause of Iran.
The stated justification of the US-Israeli strikes against Iran was its nuclear program. But Ayatollah Khomeini himself, he had issued a fatwa against the production of nuclear weapons. And more broadly, if you can tell us how the Islamic ethics view weapons of mass destruction, especially given its injunctions against fighting non-combatants.
A particular head of a government is bound by certain principles. A use of force for him is not unchecked. He says that use of nuclear weapon is haram. He could like North Korea, he could like Russia, he could like America, he could like China, he could like anyone else. So you will use it no matter what it causes and what it harms or not. This particular jurist is bound by the principles and the moral compass of a particular understanding or a religion he follows. He comes to a conclusion that no matter how much it is important for our nation, but in terms of religious ethics and morality, it's not permissible. You cannot have a nuclear weapon. They knew that the war is coming. And still this person said, no matter what, use of nuclear weapon in Islam is haram. And it's not going to happen. He gave a fatwa, which means that nation under his leadership could not go for a nuclear weapon. Take jurists or people like Ayatollah Khamenei or many people in Sunni world as well, out of this equation, it becomes a harmful beast. Anyone can kill anyone in the name of religion. But is that Islam? People like them remind you, no, it's not Islam. It's that particular organization, it's that particular individual You cannot kill a woman. You cannot kill an elderly person. You cannot kill a child. If you want to use weapon for your defense, these are the conditions that are laid for you. Who would tell you that? Either someone who understands religion himself,
yeah,
or I turn up to someone who understands religion better than me. And that's where these kind of jurists remind us about the essence of Islam.
The US designates the IRGC as a terrorist organization. But isn't a state that bombs the supreme leader of a nation, kills civilians, kills children, and offers bounties on survivors actually the definition of what a terrorist state should be? How should such actions be judged under a theological framework?
You answered it pretty much and very well in your question. And as I said earlier, when did it happen that West decides for the humanity what is right and what is wrong, what is terrorism and what is not terrorism? US can go and drop bombs over populations, and that's not terrorism. Israel can go, the Zionist regime can go and blow up hostels, schools, kill children, kill elderly in thousands. And that's not terrorism. Certain organizations get their act together and stand up for their, in their defense against this might. As soon as they stand up for their defense, that becomes terrorism. And I'm sorry for my own society, because I come from India and I'm an Indian. I see my society taking these labels from West and surrendering to that and using that vocabulary. A society which saw a person which is celebrated and to whom we pay a great respect and we should, a person like Bhagat Singh, who rose up in his defense, in the defense of his society against a might, is a hero, and he should be, calls the people from Lebanon who stand exactly the way Bhagat Singh stood for the defense of their land, for the defense of their people. Today, my society calls them terrorists. Why? I don't understand. Calls the people of Gaza and Palestine, calls them, those organizations who stand for their defense, for the defense of their people, for the defense of their land. My society calls them terrorists. Why? Because America calls them terrorists. How do we call someone a terrorist and call someone a defender of his of their rights? Therefore, the aggressors are terrorists. Defenders are not terrorists. We should not outsource our wisdom, our language to America. America, the only power in the world that has used nuclear bomb and killed hundreds of thousands.
Countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE, they are deeply invested in the US financial system. Do you think this financial entanglement is the reason why many Gulf states never can really truly break away from the US?
That is the case, unfortunately. This web, financial web, is woven in a manner where these rulers in Gulf state and the Zionist regime and America are interconnected. The rulers of the Gulf nations would always want America's hegemony to survive, and would always want Israel's presence to be in the Middle East. That's why you saw many countries, barring a few who were in the process of creating their formalizing their ties with Israel, had these events not taken place, many countries would have formally established their ties with Israel.
Today, Tehran's closest allies, its partners, are seen as Moscow and Beijing, not much of the Muslim world. Do you think that they have been let down by some of the Muslim states?
It has been the case, unfortunately, for most of the events that have taken place in the Middle East. Palestine is the primary example of how Muslim world has left alone a genuine cause, a humanitarian cause. Iran is paying for mostly, I'm not saying entirely, mostly because it was the lone prominent Muslim country which stood for the cause of Palestine. It could have gone the Arab way and lived the life the Arab rulers live, but it didn't, it challenged. And unfortunately, the way Palestine was alone, Iran today is also alone, because their primary interest is the worldly affairs, the money, the interest, their royal interest. I'm not talking about the public interest, the national interest, the royal interest of those families. That's their focus and that's their priority. They can throw the entire Muslim population or human population to dogs for their own benefit. This religious concept of Muslim Ummah doesn't bother them. They're not bothered about it.
How does Kashmir perceive Russia today, given the fact that President Putin has called Iran a loyal friend, a trusted partner? There are reports now that Moscow is also helping Iran with intelligence. Does that shape the perception of Kashmiris?
Kashmiris and those who are affected emotionally or politically by the events in Iran thought and expected Russia to take a line or take a stand which would be helpful to Iran, because at the end of the day, Russia is a power globally, which we see as a counterbalancing factor against this hegemony. And Russia will not let their friends be alone in this fight for survival and fight for their existence. Some of us would preferably see Russia playing a proactive role in this conflict.
It's been said that Pakistan is acting as a messenger between the US and Iran. Given the fact that Pakistan has been bombing another Muslim nation, Afghanistan, and during the month of Ramzan as well, do you not think that there is a contradiction there?
I'll not get into that, which nation should negotiate with what nation. They have their own questions to answer. They have a lot of answering to do for Pakistan in terms of what is whatever is happening on the both sides of their neighborhood. But for me, I would say that unfortunately, it is a lost opportunity for India, because if anyone in this region was better suited and was closer to Iran, was India. We have never taken sides. I'm talking about India as a nation, has never taken sides and has never taken side of aggression. Today, we are not seen as someone as potential negotiators. Pakistan is being seen as a potential negotiator in this neighborhood, mind you, where India is a prominent country.
One last question, Aga Sahab. How does the Western world view the Muslim world? And what, if anything, needs to be changed about that perception?
Why is it that their morality, their worldview, their political view, their global view, their economic view, their standards of liberty and not being liberated revolves around the skin of a woman? After that, the Western world looks at the Muslims through the prism of the organizations or through the pictures of the organizations created by West itself. That is Al-Qaeda, that is ISIS, that is the extremist organizations, those who beheaded people at their will. But that's not Islam.
Would argue that's their own creation.
That's what I said. That's their own creation. Henry Clinton accepted this fact. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, these kinds of organizations have killed more number of Muslims than it has killed non-Muslims. In the fight against these organizations or these ideologies, Muslims have fought more in numbers than non-Muslims and laid their lives more in numbers, whether that was in Afghanistan, whether that was in Iraq, whether that was in Syria. So do not look at us through the element or the prism or the picture of these organizations. We are fighting those organizations. We laid life. They are not us. We are not them. Do not look at us from the prism of the need, the urge of your eyes to see the skin of the woman. Eastern Hindu world, Eastern Buddhist world, Eastern, including Muslim world, can liberate their daughters, sisters, women while they are covered. While they are covered, they can be equally free as men.
Not very hard to understand.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aga Sahab, for your time.